The News Dissector with Danny Schechter. Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I'm here on the News Dissector Radio Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. And we're doing another program this week. Very important one, dealing with the question of why has no one gone to jail in this financial crisis, given all the proven fraud that took place, all the financial crimes that occurred. So we're going to be speaking today with William K. Black. William Black is a law professor now at the University of Kansas City in Missouri. He's a former federal regulator, and he was deeply involved in sending 1,700 banksters to jail after the SNL crisis. So William Black will be on with us, and he'll be explaining what has to be done and why it hasn't been done to try to deal with the clear injustice on the economic front that's taking place, where, you know, low-level people have been indicted and charged, but the high-level people have gone off scot-free. This is an issue on everybody's mind. It's on everybody's lips. We're going to hear more from a real expert later in the show. We're going to meet and talk with Martin Andelman. Andelman, who writes the blog Mandelman on MLImplode.com, is one of the top experts and one of the most passionate advocates of people facing foreclosure in this country. Just this week, the Occupy Wall Street went out into Brooklyn to try to rally support for people in the neighborhood in East New York that are facing foreclosures. Of course, poor people have been the number one victims of the foreclosure crisis. Catherine Waters was there in Brooklyn with OWS. What was the sense in the neighborhood when you guys came marching in there?
Well, there was definitely welcoming. I think people at first were a bit surprised. I don't think they've ever seen anything sort of like that in their neighborhood before. You know, because there's all kinds of, you know, people, all types, all ages, all sizes that are, you know, now in this, you know, predominantly, you know, black neighborhood. You know, people were looking out windows. They were waving. They were very welcoming.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems is, and a lot of people don't know this, a lot of the pastors, the ministers in churches in the black community were given sweetheart deals by banks, loans, and the rest of it to basically buy their silence. And hence, there's been very little resistance to the foreclosure crisis. A lot of times it's assumed somehow that the people who are being thrown out of their homes deserve to be thrown out of their homes. It's all their fault. You know, it's never the bank's fault. If you listen to the banks, they never admit really responsibility for anything. And even when they settle large complaints by government agencies and spend hundreds of millions of dollars, they still do not basically acknowledge guilt or responsibility. So this is a crucial issue in this whole financial crisis. Yesterday, I was down at 60 Wall Street talking to some people from Occupy Wall Street. One of them said, look, you know, I hope in the future we do more actions like this that really help people concretely instead of take symbolic stands. So I think you can see and that Occupy Wall Street is on the offensive now. It's not over, or as one of their signs says, it's so not over. And you'll see more actions, I think, like this. Did you have a comment, Catherine?
Well, you know, yeah, yesterday when we were at 60 Wall Street, one of the protesters got a text message asking people that they needed more help back in East New York at 702 Vermont Street, where about 20 OWS people had, you know, occupied the one house where this gentleman, Quincy, was supposedly, you know, getting evicted that day on Tuesday. And after the rally is over, it was when the NYPD kind of moved in and were trying to evict this man out of his house.
So we'll see more interventions like that. So stay tuned here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. You can call us at 888-874-4888. This program is an extension of newsdissector.com, the blog I write every day. And it's an effort, really, to try to go beneath the news, behind the news, to find out what's really happening.
Which side are you on? Come on if you're coming. Which side are you on? Just finished last night. You might be a young man with a mountain in your step, in search of El Dorado, but you haven't seen it yet. You might be an old man at your back. You can hear the trinity whispering on the track. Maybe you're a woman, or just about to be. You can hear the generations singing in your seat. But you know that it's coming, just as surely as the dawn. The battle for the future, baby, which side are you on?
Which side are you on? That's a question being asked by Jackson Brown in a new song supporting Occupy Wall Street. He tried it out at the Zuccotti Park and got a great response down there. He's singing at other occupations across the country. Now, welcome William Black from the Kansas City, Missouri. And he's here to talk with us about the question that I think is everybody, is wondering about. Why are so few top bank executives going to jail when there's been so much documentation of massive and pervasive fraud, particularly in the subprime loans and other deals, derivative deals and other deals that they've done? Mr. Black, welcome. And you tell us a little bit about your background in this issue.
Hello, first, and thank you for having me on. I am a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I have a doctorate in criminology. I was a savings and loan regulator in the heart of the crisis. And I'm a serial whistleblower, I guess, as well, on powerful politicians of both parties and such. As you say, back in the day, we secured in just cases labeled as classified as major by the Justice Department over 1,000 felony convictions of the elites, and we worked with the Justice Department to prioritize those cases with the top 100 dirtiest institutions. So we got about 500 to 600 of those convictions were the most elite of the elite. We got a 90% conviction rate. To do it required making over 10,000 criminal referrals just by our agency. We helped train our folks to spot fraud, the FBI to investigate fraud, and the assistant U.S. attorneys to prosecute it. We detailed dozens of our examiners to go and work for the FBI to serve as the in-house experts for those investigations, and we testified both as fact witnesses and as expert witnesses in the criminal prosecutions. And all of this was an effort of about 8 years. At peak, we had 1,000 FBI agents. And all the things that I've just explained to you, none of them was done in this crisis.
Well, there you go. And, you know, and to listen to all of this and to recognize that it's not being done today, and then to realize that this past week, President Obama gave a very, you know, tough speech based on a speech by Theodore Roosevelt, and I think out in Kansas, right? And he basically said he's going to bring new legislation into the Congress to try to do more to prosecute financial criminals. And yet, it seems as if there are a lot of laws on the books that are just not being enforced or not aggressively being pursued. And you know, the idea of introducing new legislation in a Congress that just yesterday basically canned his basic nominee to head up the Consumer Protection Bureau in the Federal Reserve Bank, who was there because the real candidate, who should have been the candidate, Elizabeth Warren, was presumed she would never get through, the Congress. So he came up with a new person who also was canned yesterday. So what are we seeing here? Is this a real effort now on the part of the president? Do you think there's going to be a change here? Or is this just smoke and mirrors for political purposes?
Well, so far it's smoke and mirrors because of the reason you said. Existing laws allow prosecutions, and so he has no excuse for not prosecuting the people. It all has to start, though, with criminal referrals. What people tend to miss is that we have a vast police force, all of which is oriented towards blue-collar things. If you had called up the Houston Police Department and said, you know, I think there's something funny with the books at Enron, they would have hung up the phone on you. They don't do that type of stuff. The FBI has some white-collar specialists, but they don't patrol a beat. They aren't out there actively investigating, looking for frauds. The only people that can fulfill the role of regulatory cops on the beat are the regulators, and those regulatory cops in the beat have given up that entire function. The metaphor I use is Sherpas, and because it is difficult. No one should underestimate how difficult it is to prosecute elite criminals who have the best defense lawyers in the world and are willing to spend money like water because of their vast wealth to stay out of prison. So the Sherpas do two things to get you to the top of these Himalayan mountains or this prosecution. One, they do the heavy lifting, and that means we have to do the investigative function. We have to actually detect the frauds, and we have to make the referrals to the prosecutors and the FBI that tell them, hey, here's the fraud and here's the roadmap of how it was committed and the key people to investigate and here are the key documents.
You know, back in 2004, the FBI did issue a report speaking about pervasive fraud in the subprime markets. You know, they were basically saying that it was there, but then they were saying, we don't have the task force, we don't have the people to investigate it because most of our people have been transferred to counterterrorism. And so the white-collar crime task forces were depleted. So that's one point that they've made. A second point that they've made is we see how aggressive policing can be when it comes to people challenging this system. The Occupy Wall Street has had this experience with police crackdowns, as have Occupy efforts in other cities. The police don't seem to have any problem deploying forces, using even militarized units to go after protesters who are raising these questions, but as far as going after the people who are committing these financial crimes, they don't seem up to the job.
Well, that's the second function of the Sherpa, is to serve as the guide and say, hey, this is the road to the top, which is where you have to get to have successful prosecutions. There are over a million cases of mortgage fraud a year. And as recently as fiscal year 2007, there were a grand total of 120 FBI agents. Now, that compares again with 1,000 working the savings and loan cases, and the losses in this crisis are over 70 times larger than the savings and loan crisis, but we had 1/8 as many people, and again, with no guides, they were looking entirely at little folks. So this is equivalent to going to San Diego, throwing handfuls of beach sand into the water, the Pacific Ocean, and wondering when you're going to be able to walk to Hawaii. You know, every year there are a million cases farther behind. This is preposterous. Now, to their credit, the FBI, which, as you say, warned in open congressional testimony, picked up by the news media in September 2004, gave two warnings. One, that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, that was their word, and second, they predicted it would cause a financial crisis if it were not contained. The regulators continued, however, to make the zero referrals. The Office of Thrift Supervision, the same agency that made over 10,000 criminal referrals in our era, made zero criminal referrals in this crisis.
Why is that? I mean, Catherine here is with me, and she saw you speak at Occupy Wall Street, and you got such a great response down there. People definitely, you know, find out, when they find out about this, get angrier and angrier, but yet it doesn't seem to lead to any action.
Well, not enough people do know, but you're right. The old slogan, you know, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention, is certainly true, because we've been putting the facts into the record, and sometimes they even make the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but they're certainly heavily available in the blogosphere, including our blog, which is New Economic Perspectives. It's our economics blog here. Anyway, the facts, as I say, the FBI warning was followed up by a warning from the industry's own anti-fraud experts. This went to over 2,000 mortgage lenders, this warning, in writing. And the warning had three key parts. Well, actually, four key parts. One, it said, you people seem to have forgotten that liar's loans were used before, back in the very early 90s, and they caused significant losses.
A liar's loan, just for everyone's clarity and understanding, is what?
Excellent. I'm actually going to explain it a bit, but okay. What it means is that there is no underwriting. In other words, whatever is put down on the application as to the borrower's income and job is not verified in any way by the lender. Right? So,
in other words, you could get a loan. You could get a loan if you had a pulse.
Yes, and indeed, you didn't actually need a pulse. It's sort of like the old joke about Chicago voting, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Never let death stop a good thing. So the warnings were first that these loans cause large losses in the past. Second, that they are an open invitation to fraudsters. That's a direct quotation. Third, that the incidence of fraud, the percentage of these things that are fraudulent, is 90%. They're virtually all fraudulent.
So they're not up to the 99% yet, but they're getting there, right?
Pretty darn close. And fourth, that they deserve the term used behind closed doors in the industry to describe these loans. These are liar's loans. So the trade knew that these were fraudulent loans. And, of course, what was going on is that the CEOs of the banks, the CEOs of the investment banks, and the CEOs of the rating agencies all stood to get rich if we had the financial version of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Now, one of the things... You know, you're a criminologist as well as a lawyer and a former regulator. And, you know, you have some notions about how a crime pattern, you have, I think the term is criminogenic or criminopathic.
Criminogenic environment.
Environment. Which, in other words, that's an environment that is not only conducive to fraud, but actually encourages it.
That is correct. And that is what neoclassical economics has become. Just extraordinarily criminogenic. It endorses two key concepts, one of which has several subpoints. But the two key concepts are the three Ds: deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization. And the other major component is modern executive compensation.
Now, one of the areas, we've been dealing with John Corzine, the former head of Goldman Sachs and governor of New Jersey, sort of testified before Congress yesterday. Actually, his lips moved, but he didn't really say very much other than how stunned and how shocked he was by the diversion of large amounts of money in customer accounts into the ether somewhere. We still don't know where all that money, some $600 million, has disappeared to. But this seems to be part of a pattern of what you are calling control frauds. In other words, that the people at the top actually structure a lot of these deals to benefit themselves. They try to inflate, you know, the revenues of a company, at least in writing. Suddenly they're doing very well, which justifies them in basically taking more.
Yes, the weapon of choice is accounting in finance. And control fraud is when the person controlling a seemingly legitimate entity uses it as a weapon to defraud. So among the questions that Corzine didn't get asked was, wait a minute, your chief risk officer said what you were doing was insane. It was going to put the entire firm's survival at risk. What did you do? You fired him. you decided to get a new chief risk officer, and you can't make this stuff up, right? So who do they go to get their new chief risk officer? The guy that was the risk officer for UBS on their mortgage portfolio. Now, UBS is this pathetic, often bailed out, unbelievably criminal Swiss bank that exists to launder money of some of the worst crooks and thieves in the world. And also blew up the company and, you know, does so all the time. It's on multiple bailouts now from the Swiss government and from our own Federal Reserve. And so you go to somebody who has an absolutely disastrous record and say, I don't want my real risk officer because he's doing his job. I want you because I know you won't get in the way.
You know, there's a word, I'm sorry to interrupt. There's a word called intentionality. In other words, these things just don't happen by accident. There's an intent to defraud. These people know what they're doing. These are some of the smartest people in the room, so to speak, in financial terms. It's not as if they're just stumbling around as novices. They seem to have a clear idea of the direction they're pursuing.
This is the deliberate creation of plausible deniability, right? It's not me. After all, the new chief risk officer says what I'm doing is great. The new CFO, who was appointed when he was 34 years old, he's an Afrikaner from South Africa, who had never been in the CFO, you know, line of succession, you know, even as an assistant to the CFO, but was an accountant, because this was an accountant-driven shop again that got caught even by FINRA. And FINRA is a self-regulatory body that, you know, is like a 18-year-old dog that's lost its teeth, typically.
You know, its offices in New York are right across the street from Zuccotti Park, actually, in the building where Brookfield Properties basically, you know, they do these deals, they decide to create some public space, and in exchange, they get the right to build more floors or add more real, you know, rental properties to their buildings.
Right.
And so this is sort of a deal that is actually benefiting. It's not philanthropic. It's not like, hey, we want to help the public. It's, hey, we want to help ourselves to more money, basically. And that's what's happened there. So you have an agency of the actual industry essentially being used, you know, supposedly to show that they're doing due diligence, they're enforcing the laws, they're in compliance with various, you know, requirements. And then, in fact, they're not.
No, and when they get caught as not being in compliance and are told they have grossly inadequate capital, they take the architect of all of this and promote him. Because, again, they want not just business failures, they want moral failures. They set a corrupt tone at the top. And over time, the honest people leave voluntarily or they're forced out, and the sleaze rise.
You see, and this is why, you know, what really upsets me a lot is that this reference, the whole crisis was caused by greed. Therefore, everybody's doing it. Therefore, no one's doing it. Therefore, we can't do anything about it because we're all, you know, afflicted by this sin and of greed. But there's very little investigation into the actual crimes that have been committed, which are direct and provable. But you have so many people in the media saying, well, what can we do about it? It was legal. Totally.
Well, of course, the fact that they called them liar sloans is like a sort of a hint that maybe they knew things weren't exactly kosher.
Right.
The liar sloans are perfect because no matter what anybody in your audience has been told, nobody in the government ever told any lender that it had to make liar sloans. And that includes any purchaser. So that expressly includes Fannie and Freddie. So these are the great natural experiment to understand why were the lenders making these loans, why were the buyers, the creators of these CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, why were people purchasing their loans?
Well, you know,
go
ahead, I'm sorry.
It was that they knew, again, these warnings are all public. They knew this stuff was endemically fraudulent, and that's why it had a higher nominal yield. Now, of course, in reality, they were going to lose a fortune. But for short-term accounting purposes, this maximizes income. And there's a great article by a Nobel Prize-winning economist, George Akerlof, with Paul Romer, no, not chopped liver himself, and the title says it all, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. And it concludes, for emphasis, the last paragraph says, you know, the savings and loan regulators figured this out long before any of us. But without any theory out there of fraud of this kind, the economists just didn't believe the regulators. Now we know better.
Well,
if
we
learn these lessons, we don't have to have these future waves of crime.
The problem is, you know, is that we're not learning all of this, and that's why I think you were so well received at Occupy Wall Street when you spoke there, having to repeat everything several times through the human mic check approach.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it was clear that there was a lot of receptivity. People really need to know more about this. I talk about the four I's and a P, which is investigate, indict, prosecute, incarcerate. You know, this is what our movements have to start demanding. I write about it in my book, The Crime of Our Time, in my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. I detail financial crime. You appear in it from your appearance on the Bill Moyers program. What is your last book that people might be able to get their hands on?
Well, it's got a good title, too. The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One.
All right. That's William K. Black. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope you'll come back and continue this process, because it's of education of the audience about financial crime. We're actually in a very strong moral place here to actually make demands on these issues of enforcement of financial crime. Many people are not, because they're taken in by the propaganda that all of this was done legally, when in fact it was not. Thank you, William K. Black. Stay with us for Mr. Andelman talking about foreclosures here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com.
We know that your life is hard, so please put down your guard. We'll send you a gift to give you a lift, a shiny new credit card. Don't press if your funds are low. You can use it wherever you go. Whenever you do, your debt will accrue and give us a happy.
A year and a half ago.
I wrote the song.
Worldwide Rebel Song.
Worldwide Rebel Song.
Because
it's a reflection of
and a window into
the kind of world
that I'd like to live in.
The kind of world
I'd like my children
to grow up in.
The kind of world
I fight for
in my music.
The kind of world
Occupy LA
is
fighting for tonight.
Fighting for tonight.
Mic check. Here we go. One.
Alleys of Harare.
down. Tyrants, bloodsuckers, and bagmen got us kicking through the chrome. Raise your voices all together. Motherfucker, here we come. Sing!
Worldwide rebel song. Sing out loud all night long.
Well, that's Tom Morello singing at Occupy LA. The movement is creating a lot of music, and a lot of artists are now going to be doing songs for the movement, including Will.i.am has a song, Hard Block, that he's doing. There are going to be some albums. And this, I think, will help bring the message of Occupy Wall Street to more people. One of the issues that I've been sort of mostly concerned about is, how do you basically occupy the mainstream of America? How do you get this message out? So far, the news media has been doing a lot of reporting on Occupy Wall Street. So there are interviews with various people. New York Magazine had a big feature, you know, profiles of activists, stories about confrontations with police and brutality and all the rest of it. But what's been missing is a clear messaging of the public by Occupy Wall Street itself. In other words, let's say you're an unemployed plumber in Brooklyn. You're not really a camper. You're not really an activist. You don't tweet. You don't Facebook. But, you know, you really are angry with what's going on. You can't get enough work to support your family. You know, your costs are going up. Inflation, you know, is leading to increases in food prices and the like. And yet you would act if you could, but how could you act? In other words, is there a way for people who are sympathetic to this movement, who are victimized by the financial crisis, people who have student loans, people who are dealing with possible foreclosures of their own homes? I got a call today from somebody in Chicago. Help, what can I do? I said, look, I don't know the local laws in Chicago. I can't really advise you on it, but obviously he's not alone. There are so many others who are facing the same problem. People who are out of work. Actual unemployment is much higher than the reported unemployment, because people who are looking for work after a certain amount of time stop looking, they get discouraged, and hence they're not counted in the unemployment statistics. Youth unemployment, probably twice that of the regular unemployment, and on and on. One out of two black men in New York are said to be out of work. I mean, this is a pervasive and deep problem. Hence, how can Occupy Wall Street as a movement try to focus on reaching out beyond its base, beyond the people who already agree with it, to organize more people? And this is one of the issues, I think, the big challenges that Occupy Wall Street has. How do you occupy the mainstream? How do you create media for the mainstream? In other words, if you just rely on the press is all gaga with the story now. It's been covering it, but that will fall off. People will say, well, we've already covered this movement. There's nothing new here. Whatever. And you'll see a shrinkage of the reporting unless people, are killed, unless there's some dramatic confrontations that get back into the news. The media loves violence. You know, when it bleeds, it leads. And they report on that stuff feverishly, but they don't report on the demands. They don't report on the anger. They don't report on why this movement exists and what its purposes are. And that's one of the problems here. There's a journal of theory that's come out for Occupy. It's called Tidal. I got picked up a copy. Catherine and I were down at 60 Wall Street yesterday, and we picked up a copy. It's a magazine of Occupy theory, Occupy strategy. Some of it's a little dense to read and understand, but this is from their communique here. And it says here, what do we want from Wall Street? Nothing, because it has nothing to offer us. We wouldn't be here if Wall Street fed off itself. We are here because it's feeding off of everyone. It is time that the unreal be exposed for what it is. So there is a lot of very beautiful language and appeals and a sense of community, but is this movement building across class lines, across activist lines, to reach other people? And that's the big question. Any comment on that, Madia? Ma'am?
I was just
Catherine?
Say,
yes.
Well, that's what you want from Wall Street. You want Wall Street to get off of you, you know, to get its, you know, fangs from, you know, out of your neck, basically.
Well, that's the the challenge here. But in order to do that, you have to build a movement with a strong base. You know, it was great, for example, to be at Foley Square, watch the unions march in and then march with people down to Zuccotti Park. You know, suddenly there were 15,000 people, 30,000 people, 40,000 people marching across the Brooklyn Bridge, where 700 people had been arrested just a few weeks earlier. So there are people who are receptive to this message, who do want to get involved, and it's the challenge of the movement to get them involved, to reach out to them. And that's why in this economic crisis, which is only getting deeper, the movement has to find strategies for this reach out. I'm writing about this all the time for Al Jazeera and in other outlets. I'm actually having a book. I'll have a book coming out very soon of my articles and reportage on this, going back to Tahrir Square in Cairo and the square, the Plaza del Sol in Madrid, where I visited with the activists in June. This movement has a history to it. It has a prehistory to it, and it's built in intensity. I try to cover that in my many columns and articles on my blog, newsdissector.com, etc. So we'll tell you more about how you can get that book once we're clear ourselves about how you can get it. Catherine, comment?
I was just going to say, I think people are going to learn a new way of living, and you have to get, you know, people are so conditioned to be about, you know, a job and money and just, you know, focusing on that, when now that's actually the thing that's taking people down and taking you in the wrong direction. And you just have to think in your instincts and your common sense, and it's a completely new way of, you know, living and relating to the world than people are used to. And it's going to take some time, I think, for people to find their feet.
Well, you know, I agree with you on that, but I also think really we have to go beyond that. We have to find ways to organize the unorganized, to reach out to people, to get involved in this movement. And this movement is evolving itself. It's growing in many different ways. It's so not over, as the slogan goes, and it's something that you really need to check out. There are all these websites, OccupyWallStreet.org. There's Twitter feeds. There's Facebook pages. There's so much happening. Go to Google, find out about it if you don't know about it.
It's about empowering. Like, people have to empower themselves and stop giving it and feeding it.
You and I disagree on this point. I don't think they only have to empower themselves. I think we need to build a collective movement. Anyway,
right. That
discussion will continue. Aaron Crown is joining us. Aaron is the editor of MLImplode.com, which follows and tracks the economic issues. It's a vital source of information. One of your bloggers, Aaron Mandelman, was supposed to be on the program. I spoke to him yesterday. He said okay, but I think he probably doesn't know the difference between West Coast time and East Coast time somehow.
It can be hard to wrangle.
Or he's got confused. Anyway, his blog, Mandelman, is really essential to understanding the whole foreclosure crisis. I don't know anybody who explains it better, who's been more empathetic and concerned and compassionate towards the people who are facing these problems and have spoken to more of them. He's got a very big following. Again, what's the URL for that, for Mandelman's writing?
That is mandelman.ml-implode.com.
Okay,
and yeah, highly recommended. We're lucky to have him. He's pretty much the definitive source on kind of blending both the in-the-trenches view of the foreclosure crisis with the financial level.
All right,
really good stuff.
All right, so now let's move, let's shift, let's go overseas, let's cross the big pond, let's go to Europe for a moment here and try to understand what's happening. Helping us on this also is a caller who's just come in, who's been on the program before, Yanni from Greece, who's actually been tracking and writing about and thinking about this financial crisis. But first, you, Aaron, what is actually happening now in this whole fight? The New York Times today reports a very interesting and revealing line. Someone somewhere usually makes money from bad news. That's the lead sentence, which is suggesting that despite the fact that people are facing a collapse of their economies, somebody's getting rich off of it. What's your take on what's happening now?
Well, there's certainly plenty of opportunity for that, as long as, you know, there are no big sacrifices in terms of all this odious debt that's been piled on these countries. And it really is almost hard to keep up, because daily there's, you know, a new deal, and then it falls through, and then a new attempt at a deal. And, you know, the latest thing is this debt treaty that Sarkozy has been pushing, and that seems to have fallen through, and they're going to try to meet again in May, I believe it is, but it's not really the same thing as the debt buyout, bailout, sort of the EFSF agreement that was tentatively agreed on, and it's vague at the vague level. So none of it has really been finalized or solved.
Right. Well, there's a lot of players here. One of the players in this whole issue, by the way, is the United States. You know, we talk about this as a European crisis, but we're in an age of globalization where, you know, all of these economies are intertwined in various ways and dominated in many ways by the American economy. American politicians are all over Europe now trying to press for certain solutions. They're trying to do it in a stealth manner because they don't want basically people to turn on the United States. But Tim Geithner has been traveling to five countries. Obama has been, quote, working the phones, talking to European leaders. I write about this, and this is just up this morning on AlJazeera.com. AlJazeera.com, my article. And the article is like basically what happens in Europe stays in Europe, or does it? You know, basically based on this whole idea of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It's not
right. Well,
it's not the case that there is an American involvement. Yes.
If it was isolated, the Fed wouldn't have had to do that big swap deal last week to try to keep everything afloat. And, you know, the capital that was invested by our money market funds and other funds here in the U.S., in European debt, you know, that is being withdrawn, and it's causing essentially a high-level bank run, institutional bank run, and that's probably part of the reason the Fed has had to step in. So it's absolutely a global interconnected problem.
And the Fed is working with central banks in Europe, basically, you know, but the direction seems to be coming out of Washington in many ways, and there's a lot of resentment against that in Europe. Yanni, you're on the phone with us now as somebody from Greece who's seen, you know, the crisis explode and then implode your own country. What's your take on what's happening now? Yanni is not on the phone. I don't know why you told me he was, but he's not. Okay, let's go back, Aaron. I don't know. He apparently didn't have the patience to stay for a minute and wait
well,
for me to introduce
maybe,
him. For me to introduce him properly. Yep. You know, sometimes people maybe are exploding with things to say. So where does this go now? What happens now? I mean, Germany seems to be emerging as the papa bear in this particular family, and dominating, deciding what to do, what not to do. Meanwhile, there are a lot of people in Germany who think that you know, Merkel is not conservative enough or not strong enough. And, you know, so you have this, basically, you have all these players who can't seem to agree.
Yeah, and ultimately they're going to need a strong kind of treasury-like role for the ECB and a lot more printing of money to monetize these debts if they're going to stick together. The other alternative is to break the euro apart either completely or into something like a Club Med euro versus a Northern euro. And these are all extremely big changes, and really no one wants to go either way. And I certainly can't say which way it's going to resolve, but you know, they're currently still taking official steps in the direction of trying to save the euro, but they're unfortunately not large steps or even nearly large enough steps to do that. So you're still getting these waves of collapse following every deal as market participants just don't buy it and they start pulling out. And of course, you know, there's some, of course, more than a few credible reports of some of that being nefarious.
Okay, so Yanni is back. Yanni, you're a European, you're an economist, you're Greek, you've been tracking all this very thoroughly. What's your take of what's happening now? Hello? I'm calling Yanni. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you hearing me?
Yes,
usually what happens is the host of the show asks a question, the person on the other side of the phone responds. We're responding with a lot of, you know, basically, you know, basic air here that nobody's listening or responding. So can you give us your view?
My view is that euro is going to stay intact, and we have a battle of two paradigms. The American paradigm is about printing money and subsidizing debts that cannot be paid, while Europe, with Germany on the forefront, They are trying to not do that. That's the battle. The U.S. is pushing the Europe to follow the American model and issue Eurobonds and print inflate their way out of the debt crisis. And Europe is trying to avoid that.
So there is a conflict here of economic philosophy, and this is partly what the Fed is there to do, in a way, is to print, right? The printers of first and last resort.
Right. Aaron, that's the problem, of course, that we borrow in our own currency, and Europe collectively is not, cannot quite do that. So it certainly won't work as well over there. So I think that's part of the reason of the resistance to it. But there's also the German cultural fear of hyperinflation that's part of it.
Going back to the end of World War I, when people were walking around with wheelbarrows of Deutschmarks to buy slices of bread. I mean, that memory is very deeply, reinforced in Germany. People are very aware of it. But we have had inflation increasing in the United States, although it doesn't seem to be reported very much. Example,
right.
The 99-cent store next door to me, in Chelsea, I don't think there's anything in the store that's 99 cents anymore, even though the sign out front says 99 cents. It's like $1.29, $1.39, $1.49. Seems as if the price of everything is going up.
Yes, and we are printing. We have been for a while. And like Yanni said, the U.S. wants to see Europe print as well. That's the tendency. And, I don't know if the inflation over there has been as bad yet, but there's certainly the fear that it'll get worse and kick off very quickly if that's the route they take.
If I may interject at this point, I think all our approach towards inflation is fundamentally flawed. If we look at inflation in terms of rents versus wages, we've been basically, every working person has been put way under. So this bailout, both in the U.S. and in Europe, it looks like it's gonna put the producing class, as I call them, that is small businessmen and workers, way under that just austerity does. Austerity is bad in itself because it puts the economy into hibernation, when that's bad, because the economy can hardly recover when it's put to sleep. But also, we are subsidizing high rents that have increased way above production can sustain. And it looks like we are due to support the rentier class. We are regressing into a de facto a manifestly feudalistic model.
In other words, we're moving back, not to capitalism, but to feudalism and to serfdom for a lot of people who can't afford to pay their bills. The New York Times, Floyd Norris, writes today, says for well over a century it was taken for granted that the first job of central banks was to stem panics. It was, as the phrase went, to be a lender of last resort. Until now, as Europe's financial situation has gotten worse and worse, the European Central Bank has moved grudgingly. It has lent to banks and it has purchased government bonds, but it has always protested that it does not want to do that and will not keep doing that for long. So its only legal mandate, apparently, is to fight inflation in Europe. So, we're in a situation of a deep conflict economically between countries, currencies, and interest groups. And many of this is not really well understood by the public. It's not really explained very well. And as a consequence, when people look at it, they really don't know how to wrap their heads around it, how it affects them, and it will affect them. I mean, a crisis in Europe, how is that going to affect what's happening here?
Of course, it's going to be. Europe is a big factor of the world economy, and of course, the way the financial system is so interconnected that it's impossible not to have a huge spillover effect. And that's why the United States is concerned, Europeans are concerned, the Chinese are also concerned, because they export to these to these economies. So a recession in the U.S. means a recession in China, and that's a negative feedback loop that puts everybody under. I think the biggest...
Wait a second, Yanni, hold on. Give us time to digest this, because if this is true, it's pretty depressing. Aaron, is there any cheerful note you can leave us on here?
Well, I mean, I disagree. I think the authorities in the U.S. don't want to see a repeat of September 2008, basically. So I don't really see that much of a cheerful outcome, unfortunately, unless we start by targeting the bad debt and, you know, nationalizing the institutions that can't handle writing off this debt and spreading the losses amongst the bondholders like it should be. There's really no better location for it. But unfortunately, to a great extent, they want to push the odious debt onto the public.
Right. In other words, they made investments. When those investments didn't work out, they don't want to be held responsible for losing money, so they want us to pay for it. And this is part of the whole problem with the whole bailout mentality and culture. It doesn't bail out the people. It bails out the banks, the bankers, the bondholders, and the like. And this is an ongoing saga that we've been covering here on News Dissector Radio. We'll continue to do so. Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Yanni, for joining us.
Thank you.
You can reach us at dissector@mediachannel.org. That's my email. You can check out my blog at newsdissector.com every day, where I try to cover what's in the news and what's not in the news. Please read my article on Al Jazeera, which is just up today, about the whole European debt crisis. My film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, there's a website, plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. You can check that out, too, and get the film and my book if you're interested. Wait for and look for my new book on called Occupy, about the Occupy Wall Street movement. That's coming out as well. Thank you so much for joining me. Catherine Waters, thank you, and have a great vacation. She's about to conquer a few beaches in the South, and we're going to miss her. We also thank the people here at PRN for carrying this program and doing such a good job in basically helping me package it and present it to you. Please give them your feedback and support, too. Go to the PRN website, where you'll find out more about other hosts and other programs on this growing network, which is getting a tremendous amount of audience response. Thank you, Gary Noel, for creating it. That's it for us here right now. We're going out now with our anthem.